this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You've been hearing more and more about Lyme disease over the last decade, and with good reason. The number of confirmed or probable cases of this tick-borne illness has risen dramatically since the early 1990s. The percentage of ticks carrying Lyme has been on the rise as well, and all available evidence points to a high number of ticks this year. Data on the number of Lyme disease cases will lag, but it's safe to say that Lyme disease is a growing problem in our region. A few weeks ago, we talked with tick researchers Bill Landesman and David Allen about what's happening with tick populations and within the tick microbiome. But it's been a while since we talked treatment and detection when it comes to Lyme disease. Joining us today to look at the various aspects of the illness and the research related to treatment and prevention is Dr. Jeffrey Parsonet, an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and a professor of medicine at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. Dr. Parsonet, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
So when it comes to Lyme disease, you know, this is something that we have been hearing about more and more and something that seems like more and more of an issue. But can you put it into context? I mean, a 1,000-ish cases in Vermont in a given year, 1,500 or so in New Hampshire. How big a deal is Lyme disease?
It's a very big deal. And the reason we're hearing more and more about it is just because the numbers seem to be going up at a tremendous rate. I think you talk about 1,000 cases. Maybe that was 2017. Mm-hmm. And there's a big lag in reporting, but we're probably double that or more. And remember that those are only the documented cases. The unreported cases is probably much higher. So we're not only seeing more Lyme disease, but also more of the diseases that are often transmitted at the same time as Lyme.
So the New Hampshire numbers that we have, the latest that we have are for 2015, and that was, I think, about 1,500. And you're right, the Vermont numbers are 2017, and that was about 1,000. You think that in 2018, and then the numbers, you know, which are still being collected, obviously, for 2019, will be double that for reported cases?
Well, it's a guess, but we're seeing so many patients with Lyme disease at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, and I'm sure at other hospitals in the Twin States.
So is the rise related just solely to the number of ticks biting people and the ticks that are carrying Lyme? Or is there also so much more awareness that you think it's actually being reported more?
Well, there haven't been any real changes yet in diagnosing Lyme disease. So there will be some increase in diagnosis just by provider awareness. But I think there also are real ecological changes, especially in some of the other diseases that are transmitted by ticks. So I'm sure we'll talk more about it, but anaplasmosis and babesiosis and things like that. We're seeing those cases now at an alarmingly increased rate where we didn't used to see them at all this far north as, you know, in the middle of Vermont and New Hampshire. So I think it's a combination of things. You know, as you said, it used to be that the Lyme disease was just along the coast. That was the case when I first moved to the area 30 years ago. And now we have lots of Lyme disease all the way up to the Canadian border. So it might be partly recognition, but there's a real change in the ecology of the disease.
How much more aware are providers now? Because even when we started talking about this 10 years ago on Vermont Edition, it seemed like it was something that often was not a first suggestion from a provider that, oh, you might have Lyme. Let's test for this or let's treat for it. And now it seems like it's something that's certainly more on the radar of all providers.
I get the impression that people are pretty aware.
Yeah.
Pretty aware. There's a lot of testing. Maybe there's too much testing. We could talk about that later. But I think people are pretty aware of it now.
Before we go too deep into this conversation, Dr. Parsonet, can we talk a little bit about what Lyme disease is and what its symptoms are for people who just need that kind of awareness?
Sure. Very briefly, it's a bacterial infection. And the hallmark of the disease, the early manifestation, is the rash. It's a red, non-painful rash called erythema migrans. And most patients, but not all patients who contract this bacterium have that rash. And many times people also have what we call systemic symptoms, meaning fever, headache, muscle aches, just feeling crappy. Some people have those symptoms and no rash, and some people have the rash and not those other symptoms. But generally, it's both. And After the initial phase, if it's not treated, the bacteria can spread through the body and infect other organs. And the main ones that are affected are the nervous system, so the nerves of the body, and the heart, and other joints. So that would be later manifestations of Lyme disease.
How quickly do symptoms appear after a tick bite?
Well, it can be within the first week, and sometimes it can be two or 3 weeks. Usually by then, if you're going to get it, you have the onset of symptoms. It takes a little while for the tick to transmit this bacteria. So the tick has to be in place and attached for probably 48 hours. We generally say 36 before the bacteria is transmitted. But the other infections that the tick can transmit may be transmitted more quickly. I don't think we really know. So any engorged tick
it sounds
could be a problem.
Like even 15 minutes or so for some of them is what some people are reporting.
I don't know.
Why don't we know that? Is that just hasn't been enough research on that?
I think so, and it's also possible that I just don't know. But the way I think of it is that since we don't know, that we worry about any engorged tick and what it might transmit. Lyme disease is longer, but the other ones we don't know, and maybe it's a short period of time.
Why is it hard to detect Lyme disease? Why can't we just run a test, get the results that day or the next day and say, yes, you have Lyme, let's start treatment?
That's a very good question and really one of the more important things we can talk about. The test for Lyme disease is an antibody test. That is, it measures the person's immune response to this bacteria. But immune responses take a couple weeks to develop. So when a person first gets Lyme disease, the test for Lyme disease is negative. That's extremely important, and sometimes doctors still make that mistake. So the first issue is that the test for Lyme is not positive when a person first gets Lyme. It's only positive a month or so later. And the second thing is that once you've had Lyme disease, your test is always positive, just as the case, say, when you've had chickenpox, your test for chickenpox, the blood test, the antibody test is always positive. So once you've had Lyme, you can't really test for it anymore because you're always going to test positive even if you don't still have it. And the other thing is that this bacteria is similar to other bacteria that don't cause disease but are parts of our bodies, so that the test itself can sometimes be falsely positive. And conversely, it can also sometimes be falsely negative. So imperfect testing and the fact that it takes a while to develop antibody, and also that once you have antibody, you're positive forever. All these things make laboratory testing problematic. So the clinician has to be aware of the signs and symptoms of Lyme and often treat without confirmatory testing.
You said sometimes the tests are false positives. Often the test can show a negative at the beginning because those antibodies haven't developed yet. So how often are people being misdiagnosed or mistreated in either direction, do you think?
Well, I would say often. I would say often. There are many people we see who have symptoms of Lyme, and a provider will do a test and it comes back negative. So they'll figure the person doesn't have it, but they really did. And conversely, there's a lot of people who have positive screening tests but negative confirmatory tests, who are treated, or who have negative tests. But, you know, there's this thing out there that Lyme testing is imperfect, so they get treated anyway even though they probably don't have it. So I would say there's a great deal of undertreatment and overtreatment. It's a serious problem, as I'm sure many of your listeners would relate.
Yeah, and I don't need to tell you, but Lyme disease, babesiosis, anaplasmosis, people are worried about Powassan virus. People are really scared about Lyme disease, really concerned about it, and worried that they're going to get it and they're not going to get effective treatment. I'm sure you must talk to people who just – I mean, it feels like this, even with only about 1,000, maybe even 2,000 cases a year, it's a pervasive fear among people who really like to be outdoors.
Well, you know, there's a couple aspects to that. There are fears that are justified, and there are fears that sometimes get exaggerated or are based upon misinformation. Lyme disease itself, especially early Lyme disease, responds extraordinarily well to antibiotics. Early Lyme disease, basically a proper course of treatment, which is with oral antibiotics, is 100% curable. Later aspects of Lyme disease are more difficult to treat, but also we consider them to be completely curable. The problem is that some people have symptoms for a long period of time after appropriate treatment, and that's really where a lot of the controversies are. And so Lyme disease is really not that much to be feared. Powassan virus, which fortunately we haven't really seen in Vermont but probably will, there's no treatment for that, and that's deadly, like Eastern equine encephalitis. Babesiosis can cause death in immunocompromised patients, and anaplasmosis is also quite serious. So there's a reason to take these things seriously, but with proper preventive measures, it shouldn't really keep you out of the woods.
We were talking about testing a moment ago, and you were talking about how this can take a little bit of time. Can you help us understand the new news that has just come out that the FDA has cleared some new protocol for Lyme testing that should shorten the amount of time it takes for a test to come back?
Yes, I can try. My information is probably the same as yours, the FDA announcement from 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
So currently there's a screening test for Lyme. We call it a screening test, which is done the same day. And then traditionally there's been something called the Western blot, which is a rather complicated test that most laboratories, local laboratories don't do. They send it out, and that can take a week or two before – I know at Dartmouth it takes us a week or two to get the results back. And that can be a long time when you have a patient and a doctor waiting. So the new information is that there are some new rapid tests that have been approved by the FDA, and the proposal is that you do two tests at a time, and if they both agree, then that would be a presumptive diagnosis of Lyme disease. So as these new tests hit the market, and I hope that's soon, we should be able to get somewhat definitive results back within a day.
And that would be a big deal based on what you were saying a moment ago about how early treatment can be remarkably effective for Lyme.
Yes.
1-800-639-2211 is the number you can call with your Lyme disease questions. You can also post them on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. Karen in Arlington says, since Lyme disease is so prevalent, dangerous, and she says too often deadly, why is it not treated as a serious epidemic by the CDC and most of the medical community? Now, Dr. Parsonet, can you talk a little bit about what Karen is talking about and then, you know, how you think it is being addressed?
Lyme disease is almost never deadly. It's very rare to have deaths from Lyme disease. Most of the deaths that have been attributed to Lyme disease have been due to the co-infections. Just want to clarify that issue.
Thank you.
I really can't address. I'm not active on a national scale in terms of what the CDC is doing, and especially in this political climate, what the funding has been like. I will address one particular issue of that, though, and that there's no vaccine for Lyme disease. And I think many of us feel that that's a great shame, and we would like to see the government funding more research along those lines. I mean, we have vaccines against all sorts of things, but not this significant threat. So I think we wish there was more being done with that.
As you might imagine, we've had some comments about vaccine questions as well. Joe wrote in to say, given the extent of Lyme disease and its debilitating effects, what are the prospects of getting a vaccine? I understand that there once was a vaccine. What happened? And one more from Suzanne in Peru, who says, I love to go hiking in the Adirondacks in the summer, but I feel restrained by the high possibility of contracting Lyme disease, even though I take precautions. Is there any hope that a vaccine will soon become available to protect humans from this somewhat debilitating fear?
There was a vaccine, and there were a couple problems with it. One is that it wasn't all that effective, and it had to be given every year. So, like, you know how we give dogs a Lyme vaccine, but we give it every year. And that was problematic, I think. And not only did it have to be given every year, it had to be given, like, in March or April every year because it only lasted for a period of months. It was also – there was a fear that the vaccine itself might cause people to have joint inflammation. And I don't know if that was ever confirmed, but there were fears about safety of it. One of the problems with Lyme is that, as I said before, once you test positive, you always test positive, and yet you can get Lyme disease over and over again. And it's kind of a related disease to syphilis. where we don't have a syphilis vaccine either. There are some bacteria that are just hard to make vaccines, and there's no HIV vaccine. It's not easy. I have not heard anything recently that would indicate to me that a Lyme vaccine is around the corner.
Is there just not enough money? I mean, you speak of HIV. We've certainly seen advancements in HIV prevention recently, and people who say this is something that is potentially likely to affect me. I'm willing to take medication frequently, you know, even if a vaccine was an every year thing. I think there are enough people these days who would say, sign me up. I'm okay with that.
You know, it's a very good question, and I'm sorry I don't know the answer. I really don't know. It's really bad that we don't have a vaccine, but I don't know the extent to which it's money and to what extent it's just people are having trouble making it.
On the testing, we got a note from Craig who says, why is it so expensive to get checked for Lyme for a person? It seems easier and cheaper to get my dog tested. I'm talking about the more accurate test where you have to send your blood to be tested and insurance doesn't cover it. Not the basic test they give you that is known for not being accurate. Craig says, I've talked with several people who were diagnosed negative but sent blood out, which came back positive, and it cost them $700 out of pocket.
It's a complicated test. You know, I get laboratory bills too, and they're always extraordinary. I think laboratories charge what they can get people to pay. It is a complicated test that requires a lot of equipment, and it's not a very highly automated test. Like with many other medical procedures that are done now, I think it's hard to understand the costs, the price.
Let's go to Adam, who's calling in from Westford. Adam, hi.
Hello, yes. Actually, you kind of answered my question, but I did have the vaccine back in the 90s, and I guess I know now why they don't do it anymore. But I was curious if there was any long-term effects to that.
There was a concern about that, but as far as I know, it's never been confirmed that there were long-term negative effects.
So
I think if you were to have them, you would have experienced them by now.
So no long-term negative effects, but also no lasting protection.
Absolutely, no lasting protection.
Don is on the line with us from Mount Holly. Don, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I am a long-term survivor of prostate cancer, but I'm in about my fifth year of chemotherapy, and I'm wondering, because I'm in a very wooded area and spend a lot of time outdoors, if my risk or my immune system's ability to retard the infection is any different because of my past history and my current chemo.
Tom, thanks for the question. Yeah, Dr. Parsonet.
You know, I'll answer the question slightly differently, that we're seeing so much of the associated diseases of anaplasmosis and babesiosis that I would say that your risk for having a serious complication of a tick bite is increased. I don't really think so for Lyme disease, but for babesiosis and anaplasmosis, I'll generalize your question to the listeners in general, that people with compromised immune systems for whatever reason, age, cancer, no spleen, whatever, are more susceptible to the complications. And I think those people have to take extra precautions. Another group that's at special risk are very young children, partly because they may get tick bites and not be recognized, and maybe they're also more vulnerable. So take care of yourself.
When you say more vulnerable, are you seeing different degrees of seriousness of illnesses in young children?
No, I don't think so. But if you look at the curve of the age at which people get Lyme disease, it's sort of a bimodal curve with lots of Lyme disease in young children who play in the grass and don't do tick checks. And then a second, you know, mode of increased Lyme disease in middle-aged people who are out and active.
Huh. Yeah. And as you said, it's sometimes more difficult for young children to either identify that they're feeling something or, you know, you can find tick bites in my children this year. We've had them inside the hairline and inside the crease of the bottom. And so
if you're not
checking your children in that way or they're not telling you something, it may be harder to detect a tick.
Correct.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with infectious disease specialist Dr. Jeff Parsonet, who practices at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. We're getting his perspective on the detection and treatment of Lyme disease. Lots of people calling in, and a lot of people, as you well know, Dr. Parsonet, with questions about Lyme disease, worries about Lyme disease, and things that they just don't understand or don't know about how to make sure that they are protecting themselves. Let's go to Steve, who's calling in from Plainfield. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. Hi, doctor. My question is, you mentioned earlier that if you catch Lyme in the earliest stages, it's treatable and curable, but you also mentioned it's also curable later in later stages, and I'm wondering, are the same treatments used in both stages, and if so, why does it actually matter if it's treated earlier or later, if it's curable both times?
Dr. Parsonet?
That's a very good question. The same drugs are basically used for treatment of early Lyme disease for adults. We treat with an oral antibiotic, doxycycline. For young children, we try to avoid doxycycline, so we use a few different antibiotics, but doxycycline for adults. The major difference in the later disease is duration of therapy, that for someone who has established, say, arthritis of the knee, which is where Lyme arthritis usually is, the treatment is longer. It's for a month. And sometimes that does not respond as well, and people need an additional course of therapy. The other treatment that's used typically for Lyme disease is an intravenous antibiotic called ceftriaxone. We don't use that early in Lyme. We just treat with oral antibiotics. But for late Lyme disease, arthritis, and some of the neurologic and cardiac complications, we typically do treat with ceftriaxone. It's a very good question, and the basic answer is we treat more intensively and for longer when the disease has been established.
A lot of people, though, say they have lingering effects of Lyme disease, neurological effects, joint effects. Sometimes this has been called chronic Lyme, and so we've talked about this in previous shows that my understanding is that the medical community says there's no such thing as chronic Lyme disease. However, you can have effects that still cause you problems and cause you medical complications long after treatment. So can you help us understand?
I can try, and I'm quite certain that not all of your listeners would agree with my assessment. But there's no question that people with Lyme disease can have lingering effects. And the critical issue often has been whether the long-term effects of Lyme are related to active infection, that is, the bacteria is still alive in your body and alive, or whether these are a consequence of having had infection and been treated, but still some sort of immunologic or physical abnormalities related to that prior infection. And the reason that's important is if there was still an active infection, then antibiotics would be expected to be of benefit. If these are manifestations of the prior infection, which has been cured, then a long course of antibiotics will not be of benefit. And in fact, properly controlled research studies have shown that long courses and repeated courses of antibiotics are not effective. And the problem with that is that antibiotics have side effects. We see patients getting treated for Lyme disease who have serious complications of those treatments. And of course, it's not good for the community at large to have antibiotics used inappropriately. So there's no question that people with Lyme disease can have lingering effects. The real issue is, when is another course or a longer course of antibiotics indicated? And that's sort of the basis for the ongoing controversies.
What is effective treatment protocol for people who have lingering effects beyond antibiotic treatment?
That's a very difficult one. And, you know, a lot of that will depend on what those symptoms are. People who are in pain can have pain management. People who have neuropathy can have treatment for neuropathy. There's anti-inflammatory drugs for signs of inflammation. It's really symptom-guided treatment, symptomatic treatment, but not long-term antibiotics. There is another issue with that, though, that I mentioned earlier or that I implied earlier, in that you can get Lyme again.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you know if someone who got Lyme and was treated but then is exposed to the same environment, maybe they have Lyme disease again. And that's a really very difficult issue. So repeated courses of treatment sometimes are justified if you think a patient may have recontracted the disease.
I think you and I talked about this several years ago now, but you know, I think 10 years ago, 8 years ago even, people who were still feeling and experiencing very real symptoms and very real medical problems after a course of antibiotics and perhaps after having active Lyme disease felt like they were not being respected by the doctors and nurses they were trying to explain this to. And so, you know, there's this sense that people are not taking me seriously. I know I have something. Something is wrong with me. And that for a while, it was almost a semantic argument too, whether you call it chronic Lyme or not, something was going on for people and they felt like they weren't being treated with respect or treated medically in a way that was helping to alleviate their symptoms. Do you believe that that's better now? As in, it's not, you know, people are being taken seriously and that it's better understood that there can be these lingering effects?
I'd like to think so, but I'm not sure. I think that this is a problem. You know, when doctors don't understand something, they may put up a barrier between themselves and patients that doesn't fully listen to what the patient's symptoms and needs are. I think it goes both ways. You know, I think there have been a lot of accusations that the medical community doesn't care, they don't listen, that they think we're crazy, that they think it's all in our heads. And those accusations aren't generally true either. So I think there's a lot of good listening that has to go on to bridge this gap.
You said you're not sure, though, that doctors are doing a better job of that. Why not? So much more is known and it's so much more public now and publicized.
Hmm. You know, I think sometimes as a physician, if you don't know what to do, you don't listen as well.
Hmm. Let's go to Jessica, who's calling in from Cabot. Jessica, hi. What's your question?
Hi. I found a tick on my body that's been there for a while. I took it off, and I developed this huge rash. Went to the healthcare provider, and was told that it was just a reaction to a tick bite. And at that point, I wanted the antibiotic right off, and I wasn't given it. And I had to persist the day after to get the prophylactic antibiotic. And then a day later, I had the definitive bullseye on there, went in to the doctor again, and was given the antibiotic. So my question is, why do I have to fight with the doctor to get the antibiotic? And also, are there other ticks that create the definitive bullseye design?
Thanks for the call and the questions, Jessica. Dr. Parsonet?
Yeah. Sometimes a tick bite can – sometimes people have allergic reactions to tick bites just like we have to mosquito bites. And in the area right around the bite, it can be kind of red. But from what you've described, it sounds like giving antibiotics without a struggle would have been a reasonable thing to do. It's a single dose. Most people don't have side effects from it. I don't want to cast judgment on what another physician did, but if a patient comes in to the office or the emergency room with a tick bite and a big area of redness around that bite, in this day and age, I think giving antibiotics is a reasonable thing to do. I forgot the second half of your question.
And are there any other ticks or bites that can leave that bullseye rash?
Not in the Northeast. There are other ticks around the country. In the Southeast, there's a Lone Star tick, and there's another tick out on the West Coast. But in New England, it's just the deer tick.
Given how effective treatment can be if Lyme disease is caught early, not the prophylactic antibiotics, but the actual treatment if you have developed Lyme disease, is there a problem with waiting until you develop symptoms or a doctor saying, let's wait and see if you get that bullseye rash? I mean, is there a benefit to having that immediate rapid treatment versus waiting?
Well, the major benefit is the dose. The dose, if you treat it right away, like within 2 days or 3 days of the time the tick was removed, it's just a single dose of antibiotic, 2 pills, a single dose. That's nice. If you wait until the illness has developed, till the rash develops or other things, then the treatment is for 10, 14, sometimes 21, usually 14 days. So that's, you know, 14 times as many doses, or it's actually 28 times as many doses because it's twice a day. And antibiotics have side effects. Doxycycline can cause sensitivity to the sun and a lot of gastrointestinal issues. So it's nice to catch it right after the bite so you can just give a single dose.
Let's go to Maureen calling in from Fort Ann, New York. Hi, Maureen.
Hello there. How are you today?
Great.
Well, that's great. I'm not so great. And I'm just great to turn on the radio and hear you talking about this because I've had numerous tick bites over the last 3 years. And the last one I had was very engorged. It was a tiny, tiny little tick. And I actually, it was so embedded in my leg that I used a X-Acto knife to get it out. It was so deep. And so it was on a Friday. On Monday, I called my doctor to tell her that I would like, you know, a prescription for doxycycline. She had me come in, and she said, well, we don't do that. We'll test you for Lyme. And I said, isn't it too early? She was evasive about it. And, of course, the test came back negative. And I said, well, it's because it was too early. I said, can't we just get a prophylactic doxycycline? Well, I had a friend who had some serious Lyme, and he gave me the address of a place to send the tick to, which I did. And jeepers, it came back with all kinds of terrible things, you know?
Maureen, let me move you along to just, what's your question for Dr. Parsonet? I'm sorry that you've had to experience all of this.
Okay. Well, I'm 6 months, well, quite a few months after this initial tick bite. It was last fall. Now I'm having some real symptoms. And I am just wondering what I can do about it. Will, if I have this test, will it come back positive if I have some of these diseases that...
Yeah, Maureen, let me bring that to Dr. Parsonet. So you get the gist of Maureen's story.
Yes, I certainly do.
And the symptoms that she now feels she's experiencing that could be related.
Right. So for all we've talked about the problems with testing, one of the things that isn't really a problem is whether if you have well-established Lyme disease, if you've had Lyme disease for weeks or months, if you still have active infection, the test will be positive. Now, that's not true if you have certain kinds of immunologic diseases. But as a general rule, people who have chronic infection, so really truly chronic Lyme because it hasn't been treated, the test will be positive. I'm hearing something else, though, from several of the callers, and that is the frustration people have when they go to their doctor or go to the emergency room and say, I got this tick bite. Will you just give me the pills? I think as physicians, we need to loosen up on that a little bit because it's not a dangerous treatment. And if it's given early on, it prevents the disease. It prevents a lot of anxiety. And I'll tell you, everybody now, that I keep doxycycline in my toilet kit. I've pulled 2 engorged ticks off my wife this year. I take the tick off. I say, here, honey, take 2 of these. So I have that prerogative and other people don't. I know it's very frustrating to go to your doctor and say, would you please just give me this, and then to get a no.
Even given the worries about overuse of antibiotics, you think that is worth it?
I think if it's the right time of year, which is like, you know, between March and September, and if it's really a deer tick, not a dog tick, and if it was really engorged, I think we should have a pretty low threshold for giving doxycycline because there's so much all our ticks, basically you consider all our deer ticks now are infected. It's probably 50%, but you can consider it all our ticks. So I think we have to be pretty liberal with single-dose doxycycline.
Before we let you go, Dr. Parsonet, you mentioned and we sort of briefly touched on some of the other illnesses that ticks can transmit. And Paul in Lebanon, New Hampshire, wants us to be sure to mention the recent case of Powassan virus in Maine. What should people be aware of beyond just Lyme disease?
So the big three are anaplasmosis, which is a bacterial infection. And it can cause fever, headache, and sometimes severe symptoms, requiring hospitalization. And fortunately, it responds to doxycycline, the same treatment we use for Lyme disease. The second one is babesiosis, which is a malaria-like illness. It's a parasite and oftentimes doesn't do much of anything in a normal host. But in the elderly, I'm afraid to say that's over 55 immunologically, and in people who have underlying health problems, it can cause severe disease and even death. It is treatable and responds to treatment, but often requires hospitalization and intensive care. And the last one is powassan. The last statistics I saw, it's a virus like Eastern equine or West Nile, and it causes severe brain problems, often death. Last I saw, there have been 3 cases in New Hampshire ever, and no cases in Vermont. But like all these other things, I think it's coming. Okay, all these other things weren't here before, and now they are. So we might anticipate an increase in that. There's no real treatment for that. It's something to be concerned about for the future, but not so much currently.
Dr. Jeff Parsonet is an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and a professor of medicine at Dartmouth's Geisel School of Medicine. Thank you very much for coming back and talking Lyme disease with us today.
Thank you, and thank you for callers. I understand your concerns.
Yes, and it's important to be able to get heard and to have somebody take them seriously, so we appreciate that.